Let the record show that the Hess meeting started at 6 minutes after 3 on March 27, 2008, and that Representative Keller, Representative Gardner, Representative Roses, and myself, Wilson, are present, and we have a quorum to conduct business. So I would like to recognize staff today. Kelly Burnett is with us as our recording secretary, and Sammy Kanin is our LIO monitor. Becky Rooney is my Hess aide. And before we start, just a reminder to shut off your cell phones. It does interfere with our communications up here. And we have another pretty aggressive schedule today. We have 3 bills. We've heard one of the bills previously in Hess. And the first thing we will do is we'll hear Senate Bill 285, State Intervention in School Districts, followed by House Bill 386, Energy Subsidy for Schools, and House Bill 358, Needy Children Education. If we have time, we will bring up House Bill 306, Pre-Elementary School Programs, which we heard last time. So 2 weeks ago, we heard the presentation, on a Saturday, we heard the presentation from the Department of Education and Early Development regarding Moore versus State on the Alaska rulings from the court. And so Senator Stevens isn't going to be able to make it, so Jim Lampkin will come up and present the bill. Tim, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam.
Tim, go ahead and go through the bill for us and explain it exactly what it does and why we need it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Unfortunately, I was actually expecting Senator Stevens here. He really wanted to be here to introduce the bill, but we've had a pretty busy day in the Senate, Madam Chair. This bill is before you as a result, a direct result of the Moore versus Alaska court case, wherein it was made quite clear that the legislature has a constitutional obligation to, quote, establish and maintain a system of public schools. In that case, the judges ruled that while the legislature has been found to meet the constitutional test of funding the education system, it's failing to meet its mandate to maintain those schools. It's been ruled that where schools are repeatedly failing to make adequate progress, that local control must give way to legislative oversight, and that oversight has been delegated to the Department of Education and Early Development. For your information, I'd like to read, if I may, into the record a few excerpts from that court case, which kind of shed some light on the reason that this bill is before you. The court finds that the Education Clause requires the state to take ultimate responsibility for ensuring that each child in the state is accorded a meaningful opportunity to achieve proficiency in writing, math, reading, and science. Later, the judge states that the evidence at trial clearly established that considerably greater oversight by the state over the education of Alaska's children, at least at the state's most seriously underperforming schools, is critically needed. Thirdly, in order to achieve compliance with the Education Clause requirements to maintain a system of public schools, the state must do at a minimum 2 things. First, it must establish clear standards for school districts that are necessary for the district to retain full local control. And second, the state must exercise considerably more oversight and provide considerably more assistance and direction to those schools that are identified as failing to meet the state's constitutional obligation in a concerted effort to remedy the situation. And then finally, this court has found that the state has violated the Education Clause in one significant respect. Although the state may delegate its responsibility to maintain public schools to local school districts, as it has done, it has failed to exercise adequate supervision and oversight. So this bill, Madam Chair, is a means to help provide a more direct and explicit means for the Department of Education to, when the time comes, step into those respective school districts and provide that supervision and oversight. With that, I will go through the nuts and bolts of the bill, if you like. I also have, at this time, a representative from the Department of Law and Department of Education to step in as well.
All right. And just Let the record show that Representative Seaton joined us. And do you have a question before it finishes?
Do you want me to finish first? I can save it.
Okay. Let's do that then.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the CS before you reflects some important changes that were considered a compromise to make it clear the delegated authorities that we're proposing for the department. Those you'll find on page 3.
Madam Chair, excuse me. Are we on version L?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
On page 3, you'll find lines 15, 3 A, B, and C, three little sections there that are intended to provide a very clear and bright line as to when the department is going to step in and when it shall step out. And A specifies a provision that alerts the district that they are deficient and that there are certain steps that are being proposed by the department that they take in order to not no longer be deficient. So that would be the judge's, according to the decision, that would be the clear way for the district to respond. And then secondly, under B, that there be a clear line is an end date, a time at which when the department feels that the districts have met those requirements that they can then proceed to step out under the state's accountability system. And that specifically is that those districts show a minimum of a 2% increase in student proficiencies for 3 consecutive years. And then finally, there be a petition process for districts to appeal to the State Board of Education, so forth, to either either begin or discontinue the intervention. And then finally, we also wanted to specify, not quite finally, but on page 5, lines 1, A and B there, rather than just the generic term to direct personnel decisions, we wanted to make it specific to employees that are in a supervisory capacity over instructional practices, and that is to say principals and superintendents. We did not want to leave the impression that the legislature is asking the state part of education to step in and lay off teachers and so forth. That is certainly not the intention of this bill. And then also use of appropriations under this title. Also, and finally, we did endeavor to replace the word withhold funds throughout the bill to redirect funds. And there was a legal error, a technical error on page 3 that I didn't mean to point out at this time, but since it's already my chicken scratch is on your copies there, where we meant to just slip that in quietly as a technical fix, it's before it's there in blaring red ink. So that was just a minor oversight.
All right. Representative Roses.
Thank you. When you were citing the statements from the judge, one of the points that you made when you talked about there were 2 points in particular, and I heard you say that something about when a school that is having difficulty. Could you repeat that part for me?
Sure.
That's okay. Let me go ahead and proceed. My statement in that is that we're talking about when a school is deficient, but yet it looks to me like in the bill that we don't require a particular school to then have the intervention, but we do an intervention in the entire school district. So, I mean, if you got 12 schools and you got 11 of them that are proficient, are we then doing an intervention where we're forcing all of the teachers in that district to attend in-services or attend training or interventions, or are we just targeting the one school?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, it is certainly not the purpose of this bill to affect an entire district. The purpose of the bill and the way it's drafted is to allow the department to go in and to specific to one school or the number of schools that are deficient.
Okay.
Could we have the department or someone come up? Because I've got a couple of questions. Eddie, right now it says that to get out of the situation that they find themselves in, can you kind of explain to the committee what happens to get them into that situation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. And, Madam Chair, before I respond to that, may I respond to Representative Rose's previous
sure.
question?
Yes.
I think the clarification that you were looking for, Representative Rose's, is on page 5 in Section A. It says that we may intervene in the district or a specified school.
May I follow up on that?
Follow up.
Who determines the or?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, that would be the Department of Education that would determine if it's a particular school or a district as a whole.
Can you tell me what your current guidelines would be to determine when it would be a district as a whole as opposed to as one single school?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, this particular piece of legislation is to allow the department to get down to the individual school level as requested by the courts. The district as a whole, we would still rely on the designations under NCLB. So if they have
three consecutive years?
Fourth consecutive year, we would move into a district as a whole.
Yeah, continue.
Continue, Representative Rose.
So in terms of just addressing the Moore versus State of Alaska case, not NCLB, in that particular case where we have a school that is deemed deficient and an intervention needs to take place and you send personnel in to either do training or, you know, very specific guided intervention processes that you're going to follow, do you address those concerns to only the personnel in the school that is deficient, or do you have a general overview and therefore require all of the employees or the teachers in that particular district to be involved in the process as well?
When we did the presentation on the Moore versus State case, you may remember there was a package of proposed regulations that talked about a school level that's got it. And so that particular component is focusing on individual schools. And we will continue to work through the district administration with the school board to have the school improvement plan for a single school or multiple schools within that district if the data shows. So under state interventions, it is individual schools.
Thank you. Now, I appreciate that clarification because I didn't see that distinction in here. And when it says district or single school, it doesn't tell me when which one is appropriate, because this would give you the option of addressing the entire district for one school, six.
And through the chair, Representative Roses, we do have the desk audit and intervention strategies for district as a separate set of regulations. So we do have two separate sets of regulations, one that basically applies to NCLB, one that addresses the schools as the courts have raised. And I'm happy to say the State Board put those out for public comment today.
Thank you. And I appreciate that. And we were having this conversation more to get it on the record so to be clear as to what the intent was, because I have had school districts contact me and tell me that they're concerned because they didn't see a distinction between it being district-wide as opposed to individual schools. I wanted to make sure that we all clearly understood what the intent was, so I appreciate that.
If I may follow up, Madam Chair. You should have in your packets also a formal letter of intent that was passed by the Senate that should make it very clear on the record what the intent behind this legislation is. That was passed unanimously in both the bill and the letter.
Let the record show that Representative Faircloth has joined us.
Transportation's over, Madam Chair.
And Eddie, I want you to go ahead now. Now, are there two different criteria? I know it used to be that we looked at NCLB, or is that right? NCSL. Anyway, No Child Left Behind. And we used to look at that, and depending on what the test scores were, that made us decide as a state which schools were needing to work on different things and things like that. Tell us what, and it used to be that after 4 years of not improvement, then the state needed to do something. Can you kind of just step by that, just a simple step-by-step situation so that we know. Now, is that what we go by, or do we have a different one that we go by for this situation, or do we kind of go by that criteria but different rules from there?
Madam Chair, in all my presentations, I've tried to separate the two, the NCLB versus state interventions. And the one common thread that we have in the two is the data. We're using the same data. But under the state's interventions at the school level, the criteria for that is set out in the regs that the State Board of Education just issued today for public comment. And basically, it has multiple layers that we look at. The first one is a real bright line. Did the school meet AYP? Yes or no. If it made AYP, you're off the list. Are 50% or more of the students proficient in the school? If the answer is yes, you're off the list. Then it starts digging down a little bit deeper into the data. And as long as we're seeing growth, we believe that they're headed in the right direction and local control is working. But where we don't see growth, that's when we have to take a look at the data, make a recommendation to the commissioner to intervene. And as this statute is written, we notify the district of the deficiencies that we've identified and give them the opportunity to respond before. And that's the beginning of the intervention process.
And so the first year that it happens, you say to them, you know, we're keeping an eye on you, and so they know that you're keeping an eye on them, and so kind of just go through it. What happens when something kicks in and we go in?
Well, Madam Chair, if we saw big decreases in student proficiency in 1 year, we're not going to wait. We're going to put them on notice that we saw a big drop in their student proficiencies, and that we intend to come out, do a site monitoring where we look at their instructional practices, collaboration, leadership, and then we will work with the district to develop a school-level improvement plan. And that may include putting in a school coach to make sure that the plan's implemented. It will include training of school personnel. It will require them to have collaborative meetings, document those meetings, provide that to the department. Another one is the state assessment. We have two online assessment systems which we can monitor the individual school's usage to make sure that they're using that to direct instructional practices, and then leadership training. So those are the three categories that we have been focusing on in districts that we've intervened in right now, and that we intend to focus on in individual schools to build a foundation on which to build on.
So it could happen after 1 year, or it could, if it was just a little bit, it might take 2 years or whatever.
Right. Madam Chair, that's correct.
All right. Representative Gardner had a question first.
Oh, thank you. On page 3, item number 17, beginning on line 25, it talks about notifying the legislative committee. And I guess the way this is written is we don't currently have an education committee. We might. It would be HESS or whichever committee has jurisdiction before intervening in a school district. And I'm sort of curious about timelines, since the legislature is only in session for 90 days. When do you get the test results that would trigger an intervention? What time of the year? And what's the timeline for a school to be notified, respond, and then, I mean, I'm assuming the department would want to intervene at the beginning of a school year and not in April.
That's correct, and I'm going to ask Les Morris to come up and answer that.
For the record, my name's Les Morris. I'm the Director of Assessment and Accountability for the Department of Education and Early Development. The assessment results, the assessments take place in April. The results come to the schools and the department in late May. Those determinations would be made in the time frame of the summer. They become final. The AYP results become final in early August, and it's within that month of August we'd have that analysis completed.
And AYP is for the
Adequate yearly progress. And again, that's just the first piece. There are other, as Mr. Jeans mentioned, there are other pieces that we look at, because we are not intending to use adequate yearly progress alone as a decision. There are other pieces that, as Mr. Jeans had mentioned.
Follow-up, Reverend Gardner.
Thank you. But does that mean that if you make the decision in August, since the legislature doesn't come in until January, that you can't intervene in September if you...
No, that was not the intent of that section. The intent was that the legislature be provide notice. We're not, this does not require us to get approval from the legislature to intervene, but that the legislature would have notice of what schools we're intervening in. I think that came from the presentation we did on the Moore case. A number of legislators didn't realize that we were currently intervening in districts under NCLB. So this was added on the Senate side so that the legislature gets notice from the department of those schools that we're intervening in.
Madam Chair. But the legislation before us says notify the legislative committees having jurisdiction over education before intervening in a school district under 1407.030, item 14, which is the intervening to improve instructional practices. So if the legislature's not in session, say it's a campaign year, I mean, how do you even notify people in a way that's meaningful before you intervene? It just seems to me it's an impediment to reacting swiftly when you see a problem.
Senator?
Actually, you guys did a wonderful job, and I don't really want to interfere, but, you know, I think what we heard clearly is that the legislature has a responsibility. What the Moore case has said is the legislature cannot abandon its constitutional responsibility for education. And so I think whether it's the Standing Committee on Education, whether it's the Special Committee on Education, whether it's the Hess Committee, whatever the responsible body is, needs to be involved. And even though we are not in session, we could easily have meetings of the Education Committee or the Hess Committee. And I think when we're looking at a shortened session of 90 days, we're going to see more of that. We're going to have to meet occasionally. This, your committee is going to have to meet occasionally outside of the legislative session in order to get the job done. So I think what Eddie is saying is that this simply makes it very clear, and frankly, Eddie did not ask for this. We asked for this as the Education Committee. We need to be involved. We need to know when the state is going to intervene. It's our responsibility, and we cannot avoid that. And I think that's exactly in keeping with what the judge said in the Moore case so far.
Madam Chair.
And I will turn it back to the first file staff here.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to ask the sponsor let me first explain. My concern is that if we say in statute that the department has to notify the legislature before intervening, that could be an impediment to smoothly moving forward. And I'm just wondering if we wouldn't be better off to simply say we have to notify the legislature of intervention or something like that.
Representative Gardner, I don't see it as an impediment to intervening. I see it as the department providing written notice to the chair of the committees in both bodies, making the legislature aware. Once the chair is notified, it would be up to that chair to decide what to do with that information. And then clearly we would be reporting back to the legislature, or you would be made aware once session starts.
Okay. Madam Chair? If it was sent to me, I would definitely share that with the members of my committee. I think that's appropriate. Follow-up, Representative Gardner?
I'm not certain this is the best place to do this, but it is on this point, and I just kind of like to have people be thinking about this as we go through. The testimony, the transcript of the hearing in the Moore case, and I'm sorry, I printed this only part of it out, so I'm not sure if the page number is correct, but Mr. Slotnick said, speaking to the judge, as far as the legislature taking action, the legislature is going to do what it does. We don't know if it'll take any action or not, but as far as what the State Department of Education is doing, that's in progress. That's not going to change. And even if there were action taken by the legislature, that wouldn't change the improvement plans that we have in place that we're implementing right now.
And I understand that in the context of that, you're telling the judge we haven't put this on in our trial here. But I guess the bottom line is, that being the case, I'm just a little puzzled about needing the bill before us in a way. I mean, the department can have an intervention, can go forward and do it, and is already indeed doing it. So what does this add other than legislative notification?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, what it does is it adds clarity that this body supports the department's interventions in schools. It takes the question of local control out of the equation. Because right now, when we're intervening through NCLB, one of the first questions that gets asked is, does the Department of Education have authority to do this? And there's pushback. And that pushback can cause delay in the intervention strategies of a year or even possibly more. So that's the purpose of the legislation, is to provide clarity that we do have that authority.
Thank you. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is somewhat of a problem that we're dealing with legislation that's revolved around a court situation. And what I would be hoping is that we're trying to make sure that our schools do everything they can do, and that we do it in a really constructive, supportive way. And unfortunately, you know, it feels like it's outside of that when it's this way. And sort of to that, on page 3, and we already were looking on page 3, line 27, it starts with it was continuing on with the conversation about notifying the legislative committees. And then it says, after that sentence about intervening in a school district or withholding public school funding. And that's interesting to me because I don't know how it works. You know, it's just not something I understand. And I'm wondering exactly what the procedure is there that you go through in terms of if you're notifying the legislature before you withhold funding. If it's withholding in some of these situations, redirecting might be a preferable thing to do, but would that not apply here? And so please educate me on this one.
Through the chairman, Representative Sessler, that's an excellent idea. the CS that came out of Senate Finance specifically did that. It replaced every reference to the word withhold or withholding in the bill to the word redirect or redirecting. Unfortunately, there was a technical omission from Ledge Legal that in that particular case, on that particular page and line, the word withholding was kept there. It should be redirecting. And so when the CS comes out, that will be a technical correction.
All right. Thank you.
That was pointed out earlier. I don't believe you were here at that time.
And follow-up.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I guess I know that we're talking about a court case, is there training for the people that go to work with these schools in terms of working with communities that are really up against it in so many other ways? And I just have been visiting many places and being in the schools and knowing what they're up against, and was just on a teleconference a couple nights ago with students that had been in the school that was closed in Naknek, and talking about the school closed, the town shut down. And it wasn't Naknek, it was, I think, South Naknek. And now they're flown back to Naknek to go to school. But in those kinds of cases, I mean, it's happening all over Alaska where the schools are right up against not making it. What kind of, how does the school district, I mean, how does the department work with the communities, and is it a cooperative, supportive effort?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, South Naknek is a unique situation in the state of Alaska, and flying those children to school is not something new. They have been flying their high school students across the river for many, many, many years, and they kept the elementary students on the other side of the river. Unfortunately, the population on the other side declined to a point where they were going to start keeping secondary students at South Naknek to keep the school open. And then they made the local decision that it was better to close that school and fly all kids across. So there again, that was a local decision. And that's that situation of a minimum of 10 students. And that was a policy call that the legislature made when they passed Senate Bill 36, that to get funding as a separate site, you had to have at least 10 students. These strategies here are to help improve student achievement where we see the school sliding backwards. We're not making any gains for multiple years, and they're way down here, way low. What we can affect is what goes on in instructional practices within the four walls. What we cannot affect is what goes on outside those four walls. So our focus is the instructional practices within the walls. And that's what this piece of legislation is intended to help us with. All the schools that we've intervened in so far, or districts, are showing increases in student achievement by us going in and establishing this basic foundation. That may have to change in the future. I don't know. But just getting the basic foundation established has made progress in all the districts we've intervened to so far.
Well, thank you.
Representative Gardner?
Thank you. That sort of touches on a little question that I had. And looking at the little chart you had that showed the gains in intervention over a couple of years, I mean, that's pretty impressive. There's, you know, maybe a little drop or a slight gain and then a real dramatic gain the second year. But are you saying you can conceive of a circumstance in which no matter what we do inside the building, the outside the building factors may be impediments that can't be overcome inside the building?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's absolutely a possibility. But what we need to be able to demonstrate to the courts is that we've done everything we can within the four walls.
Okay. Representative Rosa?
Thank you. I support the concept of the bill. There's a couple of things in it that I think we need to tweak, but I'll get into that in a minute. But I think to state that this is a bill that's helping us address the concerns so that when Mr. Slotny goes back to talk to the judge, I think it's in June 6th, I think he said, I would somehow like to get it on the record that I think we're doing more than just this. And we haven't addressed that. And so if you allow me just a few seconds, I will interject what I think has taken place to address some of that. Because the concern on the suit was about adequacy. And we were deemed that we were adequate. But I think part of adequacy is also equitability. You can be adequate as the state, but you may have areas or pockets where it isn't adequate because it's inequitable in terms of what the costs are there compared to other places. The Education Funding Task Force addressed that when we started clearly articulating the need to implement the area cost differentials. I think it's important that the judge understand that that's taken place. I think it's also important to understand that we have taken a look at some of the transportation costs, and we've gone back in and made an adjustment in those. That also addresses whether or not we are doing the interventions that are necessary to make sure that we can guarantee that we have adequate and equitable treatment for all schools across the state. The other piece that we put in there has to do with intensive needs and the fact that we have established a standing committee on education so that we can more adequately address what those concerns are. I don't think the judge, and certainly as a legislator, speaking on the record that the judge probably will have an opportunity to see. One of the things that I want to make perfectly clear is that there is no way we're going to fix this problem immediately. But if we can demonstrate that we understand the problem, that we are taking very prescriptive measures by which we are addressing those concerns, I think that's part of what needs to be in there. We did a considerable amount of that with the Education Funding Task Force. By no stretch of the imagination have we done it all. For example, the judge said we had to address K-12 education. Included in K-12 education are charter schools. We didn't talk about charter schools. Homeschools and some of the things that those students are doing, correspondence schools. We knew we didn't address that. But we made it perfectly clear in the Education Funding Task Force that it was in our intention by forming the committee and by working forward with the, at that time we called it the Blue Ribbon Committee, but we have addressed forming that committee so that we can address those concerns. I think the judge needs to clearly understand that this is the first step of many steps that needs to take place, but we are working towards, as a legislative body, working towards accomplishing those objectives, but it's going to take some time. It may mean that we have to go in and ask for an extension on the report so we can demonstrate clearly what we're doing. But I think if we think that this one piece of legislation gets us there, I think we've made a serious mistake. I think it's a piece of all of the other things that we have done. And I could go on. There's multiple other things that we talked about in the task force, and developing a study by which we can continue to monitor what that area cost differential is and make adjustments to it as the years progress so we have something that's fluid, also addresses the adequacy, also addresses the need base of the legislature recognizing their responsibility as to what they're supposed to do in K-12. So I would be remiss if I didn't get it on the record that those things are also part of what's being addressed here, and we do have some strategy, we do have some interventions in place, and we are working towards that end. We cannot do it in 1 year. We're not going to do it in 2 years, but at least we're moving in that direction, and I think it's important that that be part of the report to the judge.
Do you want me to respond to that?
if you want.
I don't mind. Thank you very much. I'd like to remind everybody that the state won the lawsuit in the area of adequacy. Does the state provide sufficient funds? The piece that the judge boiled up to the surface was, where you know students aren't performing, meeting the state proficiencies, you're not providing sufficient oversight, and local control must give way. And so in all my years of working in the Department of Education, we've been beating the drum of local control, and now we have the judge saying, but when you know that students aren't achieving, you have to do something different. And that's what this piece of legislation is all about, sending a message back to the judge that we heard you loud and clear, and the legislature has given the Department of Education that clear authority to intervene in individual schools.
I continue on this piece.
Representative Roses.
Thank you. Now, I would like to get to some of the concerns that I have with this. When I asked earlier about whether we did district-wide interventions, it has information that was provided to me, and I'll use the Northwest Arctic School District as an example, that when the instructional audit was done there, when three of their 12 schools were deemed to have an issue, that it was my understanding that the intervention activities that took place district-wide. Is that an inaccurate statement or not?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, that is an inaccurate statement. When the department intervened in Northwest Arctic, we went in and did the site, what do you call them? I'm going to ask Les to come up and respond to that because
that's great. Thank you.
He'll get right to it.
Through the chair, Representative Roses. My name is Les Morris, the Director of Assessment and Accountability for the department. When we went into Northwest Arctic, we did go in and do what's called the instructional audit in three schools. But we're not necessarily auditing those schools. We're auditing the district through the lens of those schools to see what happens within schools. In the case of Northwest Arctic, we looked at the 2006 assessment results relative to the 2005 assessment results. And 8 of the 12 schools in that district had declined in performance. 10 of the 12 schools had not made adequate yearly progress, many of them for 5 years. So we may need to become clearer. We feel we were clear, but obviously not, that when we're doing the site visits, it isn't that we've picked the sites that are poor performing. We've picked 3 sites that represent the district so we can get a feel for the district at the school level.
So a random sampling.
Through the chair, Representative Roses, it's a random sample in the sense that we try to pick 3 schools that represent maybe some good things that are happening in the district, as well as some things where areas where there's struggle, and also where there is a large enough student teacher population so you can get a good sense of what might be going on in the district as a whole.
Thank you. May I continue?
Continue.
Let me tell you where my concern is with this, and I appreciate that. That's helpful information. I wasn't aware of some of that information. Having taught for a number of years, there's nothing that infuriated me more to have to attend an all-day in-service on something that had zero effect on what I did in my classroom, but it was done because an issue occurred somewhere else. So you got 120 teachers at a school singing an in-service all day long because 3 people had an issue. And it seems to be a considerable waste of people's time and energy and resources. And if we're going to be taking the money away from the districts, well, let me state, if we're going to be redirecting the money in that district to other interventions that the state's taking place, I want to make sure that we're doing it at the least amount of expense possible. Because in those districts where we're doing an intervention, we're not laying off a teacher. We're not discontinuing a program. We're not doing anything that they're being funded for differently. We're just taking the money and putting it somewhere else for a piece that's hoisted upon them by a piece of legislation. Now, do we need to do it? Absolutely. My concern is if there's money available and not going to affect a program and we can redirect it to something else, then that means we either gave them too much money to start with, they either weren't spending their money wisely, or we don't think it's going to have an impact on the program to redirect the money. So my concern is not that we're doing this. We absolutely need to do this. I support it 100%. The issue I have is, do we take the money from the district that's in need to try to turn around and help them, or do we create another pool of money by which we can use that without impacting them? Now, the other side of that coin is, do we want to reward the districts that are not being effective by giving them more money by us stepping in? But and so that's that tit for tat, but I don't want to do that either. But I guess my question is, and I see that we have Dr. Eck online from Northwest Arctic. That's one of the questions I'm going to ask him. If money was redirected from their district for this intervention program, what did he have to give up in order for that money to go to the department for the intervention? That's my concern, is what are we going to lose and what is the long-range impact of the loss of those funds because of this direct intervention? I don't want to reward bad behavior. I don't want to enable people to not do what they're supposed to be doing, but I also don't want to hamper them from having the growth that they need by redirecting the funds. So I realize it's a tough one.
Through the chair, Representative Roses. And in this case, I'm not speaking of Northwest Arctic, but I will give you an example from another district where we worked with them basically in this case to redirect their funds. In this case, they had multiple set of curriculums for a few schools, and it was a lack of efficiency. And frankly, by working with them, identifying what were the multiple curriculums that existed, let's narrow this down, become much more efficient, focused, help staff development, because you don't have to bring in multiple people to do staff development, just the one for the one curriculum you selected. In that case, the redirecting of curriculum or redirecting of funds, which at that point we were just working with them and encouraging them to do that, caused them to operate much more efficiently, actually caused for staff development to be much more effective. And in that district, two of their schools that had never met adequate yearly progress showed tremendous gains out of the three schools within the district within a very short period of time. So I think that is the department's intent in redirecting, is to help bring focus to the issue at hand and help create some efficiencies when that is the case. And in some cases, some of the redirecting is to bring people to the training that may have an impact, but the long-term impact we're after is improved student achievement.
Follow-up, Representative Roses.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. That's good information. Part of what I haven't seen is, you know, there are many departments under the state, and every department that I know of has a supplemental budget. School districts don't. And so if we redirect funds and it ends up causing a negative impact, they don't have the ability to come back and recapture that money that was redirected, and if it has a negative impact. I don't know if you as a department have the ability to ask for supplemental funds. I don't recall the Department of Ed having a supplemental budget. I know every other department does. And so that's my concern, is just the balancing. And so I'm not going to stand in the way of this, but that is a real serious concern that I have, is that we're not taking funds from something that may cause us to have problems later on. The efficiency is a great example. If you could find that in every district, we should be doing that anyway. We shouldn't have to wait for an intervention for efficiency. So, but thank you.
And Wes, I have a question, or Eddie, I'm not sure which one of you, but the coaches that would possibly go into the schools, where does the funding to pay them come from?
Madam Chair, with this bill is a fiscal note for about $500,000, I believe we had $200,000 in the contractual line. We would like to use that as our first resource to hire the coaches, but the redirecting of funds would also allow us to direct the districts to hire the coaches. But as you and I've talked before, and I've explained to this committee, that's really not a very good relationship to have the district be the employer of the coaches. So Representative Roses, no, you don't see supplemental requests from us, but you may in the future if this piece of legislation passes.
And I want it to be on the record how that's going to work, because I agree with Representative Roses. I think the money should come from the department. The department should hire those people to go out. You know, that's just my personal feeling. But I think that if we take the money away from the school to hire them, first of all, it's going to tick them off. And secondly, they're just... you're going to be taking money away from areas. Sometimes you have to let go a teacher because you don't have the money to fund the something. And so people have to let a teacher go or something. And so I'm concerned about that. And so I'm pleased that we have a fiscal note that goes along with this bill, because I think it's needed. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Seeing no more questions from the committee, we will have testimony. And we do have one person off net, and that is Norm Eck. And I do believe, Norm, that you are representing yourself in this situation?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct.
Go ahead and state your name and give us your testimony.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Norman Eck. I'm superintendent of schools for Northwest Arctic Borough School District, headquartered in Kotzebue, Alaska. And I'm very pleased. I'm sorry, we're in the midst of a board meeting today, and we took a break. I got in about 10 or 15 minutes into after 3 o'clock, so I missed the earliest discussion that went on. But I really appreciate the discussion that went on. I think this is really, I think folks are getting to the heart of the matter, to the heart of the concerns, and I really appreciate the bill's sponsor, Senator Stevens, for being open to the improvements, dramatic improvements that have been made to this bill from how it was first introduced. I really support SB 285. I think that this is necessary. and Representative Rose's is correct. This is only a first step. But by calling attention to these factors, that we expect all children to be successful, and successful academically, that is their constitutional right in this state. And so what light we can focus on this will improve the futures for our children as they grow into adults. So this is an important piece to begin with. In terms of, there was one statement, however, when Mr. Jeans and Mr. Morris mentioning about our intervention. All we ever had was a discussion with the commissioner on our situation, and we were very much informed that the intervention was truly focused on the three schools that we were audited on. After all, we have a number of schools that are doing well. And we are experiencing growth in across the district, and we're very pleased and proud for that. We were involved in a district-wide improvement plan before we ever became intervened upon by the department, and this was something that I'm sorry, there was a disturbance there. And so we were very much a partner with the department all along in terms of this situation. So we've been pleased to partner with the department, and we expect to continue to have the growth, that's needed and deserved for these students. However, we feel that a much more focused intervention is what will make a difference and what will make a true difference. Those three schools that were cited in our audit that were audited were selected because those were three that had relatively flatline performance over an extended period of time. And we're pleased to see now our formative assessment results this year. We see growth going on. We expect things to be improving dramatically in those schools. And it will be a much better situation coming on. But we think a much more focused approach would be far superior because we've had a great amount of our students in well-performing schools with those teachers having to be involved in activities that there would be other activities that would be better suited to improving the situation with those students. That would be a much better, there would be much better activities to involve them on. Also, the fiscal note on this for this bill is inadequate. There needs to be additional resources. We don't have the infrastructure up here that exists in the mainstream cities that we have in our state. I don't have a full-time school psychologist. I can't afford one. In order to make differences, we're going to need specialty people such as school psychologists, additional speech pathologists, community school liaisons to help with attendance and other kinds of things. And you know, it's correct. We have to focus on those things that go on in the school. And there's so much we can do there in the schools to make that difference. However, we need just sometimes that little extra help can make all the difference, especially with children. And so I think there needs to be, like suggesting for those five districts, I think there needs to be a pool of $5 million that we can apply to get that extra help to provide the support for our schools that we need to make that difference. But again, in summary, I believe that we need the bill. I'm looking forward to reading the regulations as the discussion was going on. I couldn't find that they were posted yet, so I'm very anxious to read them. Without the bill, we wouldn't have had regulations. This has been somewhat of a black hole that we're sucked into, and not knowing exactly the aspects of where we're at, where are the milestones, what are the benchmarks, where's the exiting, because we intend to have growth and improvement for all of our students and to be able to exit from this. The department has been communicative with us on the issues that as we've gone along and willing to work with us. But there were great errors and flaws in the going into this. The department should have been ready in the first place, in terms of moving into this, and all these things should have been clarified up front. I think there was a desire just to show that we're going to move in, and that's too bad, because there were a number of things that were very harmful to the schools, harmful to districts, and harmful to personnel. We're going to experience a much higher turnover rate as a consequence now. I've spent a lot of time, a lot of money in training our staffs. And in one of our schools, Selowik, I have over 50% of the teachers now. Out of over 20 certified people, over half of them are leaving. They say, why should we put up with this? We're doing all this extra work. There's no extra leeway for us. It's just a lot of work, and there's a need for teachers everywhere. We can go to a district where they're not under intervention. And so this is something that there's the side issues that come up that are momentous. We want to work to institutionalize great practices, but you institutionalize that through stability of staff. And if I have another site where I have teachers that have been there for a number of years, and I say, well, I want to take the best teachers from here. Let's say I've got five great teachers in Kotzebue, and I could transfer them to Kivalina, or I could transfer them to Selowik, and let's help them really move that school forward. They'll say, I don't want to move. You're going to make me move 70 miles to another village and dislocate me here? They're not going to do that. They'll take their options elsewhere. So there's a lot of depth to these issues that have yet to be looked at, yet to be examined. But again, we do need the clarity that we're stepping into with 285. We need to move into this, and it's an appropriate step to take. And I appreciate the improvements that have been made. I did email the three, and I think I heard a couple of these things mentioned here, but I did email to the chair my additional three recommendations, and I think they were attached to the bill as it moved out of the Senate moving forward. So, again, I thank you so much, and I do support the department in this, and I support the work on the behalf of the folks that are there today as well.
Okay, thank you very much, Norm. I'm going to... I've been told that there's no one else online. No one signed up for this bill here. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing no one, I'm closing public testimony. And is there any more discussion that the committee would like to have? Because I don't intend to move this bill, because there's a lot, I think, that we need to look at, and we'll bring it up at another time. But I do want to have some discussion. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record and for committee members, we accept public testimony, and anyone can have any position on any particular thing. And I say that for the record because there's a legal case that's involved here, and that by not asking questions does not mean that I agree nor disagree with the things that are presented before us. And so there was a statement made by the previous speaker during public hearing that the department should have been ready. And I believe from the department's perspective that the school district should have been ready, and that the school district was communicated with as far as the program and the analysis and the ways that we were trying to track their meeting particular requirements set out by the federal government and by the state of Alaska. And that previous speaker also spoke to harmful consequences to intervention, and so I appreciate that districts are being involved in the process so that we can talk about how the state would intervene in a local control situation so that it only does good and does no harm to school districts. And I do concur that we need to institutionalize best practices, but it's sometimes difficult at a state level when local school districts want to maintain that control, and we're being told at least to consider by the court system that we do need to intervene when that progress isn't being made. And so I have been sitting and listening very diligently to the conversations that we've heard from all different aspects of the people presenting, and I just wanted on the record, as it is always with us, that we do listen and we cogitate and we rethink and we debate, but it doesn't mean that it's a statement of fact just because it's said on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could I ask the assessment, Les?
Les?
Thank you. On page 3 of the bill, on line 20, where we're talking about the end date for a departmental intervention of not less than 2% increases in student proficiency, and the intervention charts that you gave us list proficiency far below advanced, et cetera. Do we have a definition on where that proficiency is? Is that average proficiency? Is that 2% reaching the proficient part, or is it going from far below to below proficient? Is that going to be considered an increase? I just want to get a definition of what not less than 2% increases in student proficiency, what that means, so that we're all clear.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that would be based on there's four levels of proficiency on our tests. There's the far below, the below proficient, and then there are two above the line of proficiency, proficient and advanced. And what we would be looking at is how many students are actually considered proficient above that line, either proficient or advanced. So in this measure here, growth from far below to below itself would not be enough. We need to see students actually becoming proficient, and in this case then applying that to groups of students. We need to see groups of students increasing by 2% within the school in each of the three content areas of reading, writing, and mathematics. And so the students would have to, at least 2% of the students within that school would have to become proficient that aren't, a gain of that amount in all three subject areas for the consecutive years.
Okay. Follow up, Madam
Chair. Follow up,
so just for clarity then, if we look at your graphs, your charts, we're talking about the green and the yellow, the line between the green and the yellow. It doesn't matter in this assessment for getting out of here if we had a high percentage of people move from the green, the proficient block, to the advanced, or if they're moving from the far below to below. Those aren't in the calculation. It's counting the number of students. The 2% is the number of students that raise at least 2% in each one of those three assessments. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is correct. We're looking at those going across that line to become proficient and making sure that increases, because that's ultimately the goal we want for every student, is at minimum to be proficient or better, hopefully, but at minimum become proficient.
Thank you.
I have a question. It has to be somebody that's already below proficient that increases by that 2%.
Chair, yes.
Okay.
So that's the group we'd be looking at to see gains within that. Yes.
Any other questions?
You mean for less or for anybody?
Yeah, for anybody. But I have, you know, I don't think what you just said isn't what this says. Because you said that there had to be a group or of at least 2% of the students increasing in proficiency, and I don't think this says that. Or maybe it does, but is that what it's... In student...
Chair Wilson, I guess that, just to be clear, that is our intent. That was how it was written as we worked with the Senate side. That's where the exit language came into play, and it was really intended to see, you know, student proficiency increasing within schools by 2% in all the content areas. And if you could show that consecutively over 3 years, we would have the belief that the system is in place to continue that.
Okay. Okay. Representative Seaton.
And Madam Chair, that's why I was asking the question for the same reason, because, you know, proficiency, is proficiency the line, or is the 2% increase in proficiency an increase in measurement, a growth measurement? And so what I am hearing and what we're putting on the record is that the 2% increase is in the number of students that pass the line of from below proficient to above proficient, and has nothing to do with those that move from the proficient to the advanced, or from far below proficient to below proficient. Those measurements are not going to yield any of this increase in student proficiency. It's only when they cross that threshold, and there must be at least 2% of the students for each major. They don't have to be the same student, but at least 2% increase in students that are proficient in math and reading. Is that
writing?
Okay.
Follow up on this point.
Representative Rosen.
The problem with this particular assessment is if you focused all of your energy and resources on those that were below efficient and you were able to bring 2%, 4%, 6% of them up into proficient area, but at the same time, because you focused everything down here, you now have 4% of the kids who were in advanced that are now in proficient, mm-hmm. It doesn't show up anywhere in terms of whether they've made proficiency or not. So I guess the question is, where do we identify that, and how do we address it to make sure that those that have already reached a certain level don't drop back?
Les.
Through the chair, Representative Roses. We do look at all the growth of all the students as we look at whether we ought to intervene in that school or not. I think what we were trying to do with the language in terms of the exit strategy is come up with a clear, pretty straightforward, defensible red line that says if you cross this, if this happens repeatedly, we know that something in that school must be occurring. You must have the infrastructure in place to continue those kinds of gains. And I guess we were trying to avoid the complications of the exit strategy. There are complications, but we think they're important complications, and they provide multiple indicators about how you get into this position. So the exit is that proficiency, because that's the basic level we want for every student. But I will say we're never going to stop looking at growth, and I don't think districts are going to stop looking at growth as long as we can include those kinds of measures in our accountability system in other ways as well. And we do have them included both in how you get into this position as well as in the federal accountability system. We now are including the growth factors.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may.
Representative Rose.
And I appreciate that. And I know that we do track individual students, so we know what their individual growth rate is, and that's important. But I don't want us to begin teaching for mediocrity, and that's the biggest concern that we have. And if we're focusing on whether or not we're satisfying the issue at hand with this bill, and that we use a 2% proficiency increase, and assume that that's all we need to do, I want to make it clearly understood that it's not our intent that we teach for mediocrity. We want to see every student succeed. We want to see every student have an opportunity to succeed and have an increase. And we do that by tracking individual growth along with the model that you have created here for this measure. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, that is correct.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We're going to set this bill aside. We're going to go to House Bill 386. Energy subsidy for schools. Representative Ledoux's staff is here, and could you give us a brief refresher, just real quick, because we did hear testimony in this bill, but we haven't had the committee discussion yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Thomas Brown. I'm an intern in the office of Representative Gabrielle Ledoux.
House Bill 386 was drafted in response to a number of requests made by school districts throughout the state. While there has been a lot of legislation occurring to help schools pay for their bills, gas prices have increased over 110% in the last 13 months. It's difficult to maintain your budget that you create on one end of the year when the other end of the year, the numbers that you base your budget on are completely invalid. You should have before you, as part of the testimony for Carl Rose, Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards, who unfortunately is not able to come today, but as part of the testimony that he had prepared, a list from January 2007 to this month of how the gas prices have changed. January 2007, school board submits their budget. The price was $51 a barrel. When fiscal year 08 begins in the summer of that same year, the price for barrel of oil was $76. Now, just 8 months later, price is $110 a barrel. School districts around the state have had to fire staff, cut back on hours, close school programs, close entire schools in some cases, consolidating the different programs from secondary schools, high schools, and elementary schools, putting them all together because they just can't afford to keep the school running anymore. It's important to remember that it costs the same to heat a building regardless of how many people are in that building. There are a number of initiatives that a number of the school districts have already instituted to try to mitigate their energy consumption and their energy costs. Unfortunately, these are not universal solutions. They're not applicable in every situation. Some of them, they're impractical. Some of them, they're cost prohibitive. And some of them, they're just plain impossible. I'm not sure. I believe I saw on the sheet outside that nobody signed in, so I'm assuming I'm been tossed out to the wilderness by myself today. So I'll try to do as much as I can for you. Is there somebody online? There should be somebody waiting to testify online as well. Thank you, God.
You got a reprieve.
We do have one person online. So
okay. So We drafted this legislation in response to the people who need it. And with that, I'll try to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Representative Roses.
Thank you. One of the factors that we considered in the area cost differential, one of the things that makes up the area cost differential, is the difference in fuel for the different parts of the state. Now, with that being said, I realize that for next year's budget compared to this year's budget, there was no increase. All we did was take the 50% of the area cost differential and take it as a one-time funding and put it in statute where it becomes fixed. So there was no increase there, and it was significant fuel increases. But I can't support this bill the way it is simply because we had school districts that budgeted or fuel based on what their prior costs were, and they built in a certain projection for what they thought the increase was going to be, and they're not better predicting what gas and oil prices are going to be around the world than when the specialists can't do it. We can't expect school districts to do it. So I realize they're at a severe disadvantage. But to anticipate that the state would pick up 50% of the actual cost is substantially different than asking us to pick up a percentage of the increase in cost. There's a substantial difference in between those two. So I have serious concerns over where this bill is going, and I think it's leading us in the wrong direction. And as we go a little farther down here, I more than likely will be offering an amendment to this bill. But I like the concept of the fact that we're trying to help offset it. And certainly, when we looked at the education funding, the governor disagreed with where we were on funding, a difference of $100 in the BSA. That amounts to about $22 million. But what you've got here on an increase in the first year alone, as a fiscal note, I believe is $72 million, if I remember. Yes, a little over $72 million. That's about $300 increase to the BSA if we were to look at it from that perspective. But if you go back and calculate what 50% of the increase would be, it would get us up to about what that $100 increase in the BSA would be. So I quite frankly can't support this, but I will be offering an amendment to change it to 50% of the increase over the previous year as opposed to 50% of the actual cost.
Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I was curious on the same. We have a chart here, chart one, with Southeast Island School District, and which had 2006, 2007, 2008. And, I mean, it seems to be that what the bill talks about is even though we're not doing 2006, it would be essentially saying we're going to pick up half of the budgeted amounts that were for all energy costs back when it was low as well. I'm trying to figure out how we're, like Representative Rose is here, that we're not talking about an increase. We're talking about the total energy cost. And I'm just, did you look at that, or is this?
That was part of the help I was hoping to have today. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I will try to answer that. As many of the school districts have made attempts on their own initiative to mitigate their school costs before passing a school board and city and borough resolutions asking the legislature for money, there isn't anything around right now that can help the school districts with these issues. That's why they're asking for a direct contribution, just as you say, just a handout, because they need help now. Not later. They need help now. That's what I've been the gist of every conversation I've had with superintendents from Privilof to Cordova to all over the state.
Okay. Any other questions? Hearing none, then we will go to online. We off-net. Actually, we have Jim Langton from Valley School District.
Yes, can you hear me?
We can.
Great. I appreciate you folks for always carrying forth the fight for education. This is Dr. Langton with Denali Borough School District. Just wanted to share with you the cost that we've had to incur the last couple, two, 3 years in regards to electric and fuel costs. In FY06-07, we had a total of $166,000 plus for electricity, about $260,000 in fuel. This year we budgeted $170,000 for electricity, $277,000 for fuel. We're about up to that now, and we still have temperatures below zero at night. We do have one power plant that runs on coal, and we're thinking about doing that in our other schools, but there are other issues with coal as far as where to put the ash and so forth that makes it a little bit problematic to move forward, plus the size of the buildings. So we are doing what we can do as far as making these costs lower. As you might know, Usabelli Coal is here in Healy, and so our Tri-Valley School in Healy does use coal, but it has to only be burned when the temperature is at a certain degree or it's just not feasible. For next year, we're looking at increases of both to electricity. We're looking at about $182,000, fuel and coal about $310,000. I appreciate the comment made earlier regarding the fact that it's just about impossible to predict, but based upon what we've actually seen in the last 2 years, a prediction of where we're looking at next year with 10 to 15% increases likely will be conservative, and we're worrying that that may be conservatively enough, but it could also not be. So these are costs that are eating into the very appreciated amounts that we've had increased to our BSA. But frankly, in our district, the increases we've had, we're still making cuts for next year in our budget because of some of these increases in other places. And just wanted you folks to be aware of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Langton. Representative Roses has a question for you.
Thank you. Dr. Langton, can you tell me what you budgeted last year for energy costs for your district compared to what your budget request is that you initially have for next year?
For last year, 06-07 year, I'm not sure what was budgeted, but we did actually spend $166,000, almost $167,000 for electricity. For fuel, it was about $260,000. This year, we budgeted $170,000 and $277,000 respectfully, and with the increases, it looks like those budgets are going to be, we're going to be going over those predictions that we made for the budget, and for next year we budgeted another 10-15% higher. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Let's see if we can put it in numbers. Since you were rattling numbers off there, I was trying to add them up in my head. But basically, if you were to add the two together, you had roughly about a $30,000 increase in your actual and what you're budgeting for next year. Is that correct?
Let's see.
28-something is our, if I added them correctly in my head.
Yeah, we're looking at, I would say closer to $40,000 increase budgeted.
Are you aware that this particular bill would not even pick up the increase, but would give you half of everything that you spent? So if you are projecting an increase of $40,000, this bill as it is written would actually give you $256,000.
I was not aware of exactly how the bill is written. I do know that our costs are going up very high. Frankly, this year we do appreciate the $100 that we received on our BSA increase. That's been translated to about $14 increase in this district because we lost our school improvement grants. So we are frustrated on various levels, and we hear that maybe paying for 50% of our fuel costs, even if it's only 1 year, it's going to take into account what we thought we were going to get on the BSA, but frankly did not.
Thank you.
And I'm hearing that story from various superintendents in the state as well.
Right. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this bill? Come forward, please.
For the record, I'm Bruce Johnson, and I'm employed by the Association of Alaska School Boards, and as Thomas indicated, Carl is at the national conference and unable to be here. So he just asked me to just come forward, and we are supportive, obviously, of districts receiving assistance for the extraordinary costs related to energy. The form, how you choose to do that, that's a policy call, that's up to you, but clearly there are lots of numbers out there that all show that energy costs are going up, and it's been very difficult for districts to keep up with that. So we do encourage you to consider this seriously, and whatever you can provide, I know will be appreciated by our member districts. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Bruce? Thank you. All right, I'm going to close public testimony, and Representative Roses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a conceptual amendment, number one. And what I'd like to do, and it probably would start on line six, but I would like for Ledge Legal to put it where it properly needs to be. But the intent of my conceptual amendment would be that we would change this to not be 50% of the actual cost paid for energy for the school districts for fiscal years 07 through 09, but it would be 50% of the increase of the previous fiscal year.
Hearing no objection, so moved. Representative Faircloth.
Just for clarification on that amendment, does that mean that it wouldn't be for the multiple years, but just for from a previous year?
Would my intent of the motion that would be, since they have the actual cost for 07 and we're projecting what it would be for 08, this bill would start with picking up 50% of the cost from the of the increase from 07 to 08 and then from 08 to 09.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2 years.
Do I hear any, what are the wishes of the committee for this bill?
Madam
Representative
Chair.
Gardner?
I actually just have a question. The bill originally is written for the fiscal year 2-7, and your intent is that Representative Rose is not for the increase
between 2006 and 2007?
My intent would be that the, because they already have their actuals, they've already spent their money for 2007. My intention would be to get them 50% of the increase over what their actual expenditure was from 2007 to what it is projected to be for 2008, and then from 2008 to 2009, and then once they have the actuals, then that can be readjusted. So my intent is we give them 50% of the increase from the previous fiscal year, from 07 to 08 and 08 to 09. We can do it on projections, and then once they're, it's finalized, then we can make an adjustment to that based on what the actuals are.
So I want to clarify that then. So you're giving it for 2 years?
Correct.
All right. Representative Seaton.
And I would just like to get the department up to comment on the logistics of how that would work as far as the funding. Would they anticipate supplemental? Would they anticipate that it would be done on a projection and in the next fiscal year we would come back and fund the actual, just to get some thought from the department on the mechanics of how that might be accomplished.
Eddie?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Seaton, the way I see this happening is we do have the 07 already. You have an estimate of 08, so you could provide us with an appropriation for fiscal year 09 to make that first payment for the 50% difference between 07 and 08. We will receive the financial statements during FY 09, so we will know what the actual increase is. We can calculate it, distribute the money based on the appropriation, and if there's additional requirements, we can come back and ask for that through a supplemental process next year.
Okay, follow up.
Representative Seaton.
So this would be basically in a capital budget item this year, or in a budgetary item in the 09 fiscal budget that we're considering now, and then that would be immediately paid to the school districts for the past fiscal year, and then am I understanding that correctly?
The funding would be allocated to the school districts in FY 09 based on the 50% increase from 07 to 08. And then we would have another appropriation for FY 010, as I understand Representative Rose's amendment, that would provide for 50% of the increase from FY 08 to FY 09, but those monies would not be available to the districts until 010.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Trying to follow the money.
Representative Keller.
Eddie, thank you. Would you explain would this have any effect on the requirement of 70% in the classroom? What is this going to do to the districts that we're struggling to get that percentage, where this money will be, if I understand it right, would not qualify, or would it?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I would argue just the opposite, that this would free up money that they're having to direct to non-instructional items right now that they could put back into the classroom.
This wouldn't require the 70%.
But they're having increases in fuel. Fuel for operations is non-instructional. So if you provide them relief on the non-instructional, that money can be redirected back into the instructional component.
Okay. Representative Roses.
Eddie, we've had this discussion numerous times, but just to make sure that we have full understanding and clarity, what is roughly the cost of a $100 increase to the BSA?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, now that HB 273 was signed today, roughly $22 million.
Okay. Thank you. And if we take a look at the spreadsheet that was created for us, and you look at the forecast at FY 208 energy cost, and compare that to actual energy cost, and you just look at the total at the bottom of the page, and you subtract the two, you come up with roughly $19,542,000, which is just short of a $100 increase to the BSA. So it not only gets us within the realm of being able to provide assistance to the districts, but it brings us up to the level that the governor had requested in her budget to begin with. It's just another way of getting there, but it doesn't put it in the BSA, but does put it in the district coffers nonetheless. That was why I made the amendment.
Through the chair, Representative Roses, your math's correct, but you forgot one step, the 50%. So there would only be $10 million allocated through your amendment.
The student's not supposed to correct the teacher. But point well taken.
I like right. Where you were going, though.
Do I hear, what does the committee want to do with the bill? Do I hear a motion?
We didn't have any objections, so the amendment was adopted.
Yes.
Is that
yes.
Correct?
Sure.
Make it pick up the whole increase.
Well, that would take care of the otherwise, isn't it?
Let's take briefity.
Yeah, briefity is
already in it. Beginning.
I mean, I want the districts to have the money to do the education, but we consistently send the money in packages that don't have to do with, you know, directly. Sure, the argument exists that it frees up money, but we need to use the money, I think, to provide an incentive to fix some of the things that are staring us in the face. And dropout rate is one of them. And so I'm going to vote against it, and I hope that someday I'll be able to vote for a real big spending package that is directed at instruction in the classroom.
And I feel indirectly this definitely is, because right now the schools are having to some of them are having to get rid of a teacher so they can pay their fuel bill, you know, and if we can help them out so that they don't have to do that, that's keeping the money in the classroom. So Representative Seaton, did you want some?
Nope, you made the point I was going to make.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciated the math lesson as we were going forward.
Or the attempt at one.
And I think that, we are looking at about that figure that Representative Rose has said. So I'd like to make an amendment to strike 50% of and just have it the increase in fuel costs.
Madam Chair, object. I have a question.
Okay. There has been an objection, and Representative Gardner has a question.
Do I understand correctly that if this passes, the amendment passes, then what we're actually doing is the equivalent of if we had done a $200 BSA increase?
No, one, because I forgot to divide it in half.
This amendment would get us to 100. $100 over what we've already passed.
Yes.
$200 for the year.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments? Representative Seaton?
Oh, no. That's the case.
All right. Representative Fairfall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Should the amendment pass, then I'll be a no vote. People have to estimate costs and make decisions on budget. And if we're now paying 100% of people guessing wrong for energy prices, I won't be able to support that. So I Representative Rose has made it a sound business decision for me that we have increases and that we're going to share in the cost of those increases, with the actual cost increases. But if we're going to decide that we're taking it all in the state, we're setting false expectations up. I know that this is limited to 2 years, but when we offer the carrot, it's going to be expected in the future. And we've already passed a three-year plan that does have multiple areas where school districts are seeing increases. And so I'll be a no vote on the amendment.
Okay. Are you still going to have your amendment?
Sure.
Okay. Call the roll.
Amendment 2, HB 386. Representative Fairfax.
No.
Representative Keller?
No.
Representative Steeton?
Yes.
Representative Sisson is absent. He's not present. Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Roses?
Yes.
Chair Wilson?
Yes.
I have four yeas, two nays.
Okay, the amendment has passed. And now we have the bill before us. Representative Steeton.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 386 as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
I'll object.
Okay, there's been objection. Any discussion? Would you call the roll? Oh, yes. I'm sorry, but...
Would you like me to withdraw the amendment or the motion?
Please. And then what we need to do is to add that we're an updated fiscal note to go with it.
Madam Chair, I would withdraw my motion.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 386 as amended from committee with individual recommendations and updated fiscal note to follow.
All right. Hearing no objection.
Oh, I object.
Oh, same thing. Sorry. Okay, would you call the roll?
Talking about how I could have messed with the chairman on the last amendment. Sorry.
HB 386, as amended. Representative Keller?
No.
Representative Steeton?
Yes.
Representative Sisna is not present. Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Rosen?
Yes.
Representative Faircloth?
No.
Chair Wilson?
Yes.
And four yeas.
So we have passed this bill out of committee, and what we're going to do quick is I would like to bring House Bill 358 before us, and the only reason we're doing this is go ahead, Representative Guerra, and explain to us, and then I will still do this at the end.
Oh.
Okay. Please explain to us the changes that were made and what is the bill consists of now.
No.
We haven't introduced this bill.
Oh, you know what? You know what I'm going to do? I want to do it the other way around. I'm going to do House Bill 306. Sorry. Okay. So now explain the changes that we made.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Les Guerra, District 23, with my aide, James Feldman. After the last committee meeting, what we decided to do, or what I believe the committee decided to do, and then we got a CS drafted, was actually pass the part of the bill or rewrite the bill so that it was only the part that said the State Department of Education should come up with a plan for early education, but delete the part that says when and how it should be implemented. And so we would have a plan first for a statewide early education program that's voluntary. We sat down with the department. The department is willing to go ahead and do that, and they're supportive. And there's one typo, I think, in the CS that we need to correct. But the bill as it reads now is just the part on page 3, which says the state shall devise an early education plan. And then the part on page 4 that just adds to the duties of the department so that the department has the power to do that. And it says that the state has the power and the duty to devise an early education plan. So the only typo that we saw in the CS was the part that we took out was the implementation of the plan. So at line 1 on page 1, the words and implementation need to be deleted from the title. But that's where we are. I now see that James has drafted an amendment to do that.
Okay. And what I'd like to have a motion that we bring Kimmy substitute version W before us.
Which is good. So moved.
All right. Now we have it before us, and so if you have that, I'll take it. And thank you. And any questions with the committee members? No, they don't. We don't need it. Yes. No questions? If there's no questions,
I'm looking for the amendment, Madam Chairman.
Oh, it's and just, I have it right here. It's two words.
Yeah. And the amendment takes out in the first line.
Go ahead and move the amendment.
Go ahead. You go ahead and.
I was just waiting if there were any questions. I was going to offer amendment number one.
Okay.
Amendment number one would. On page 1, line 1, delete the words and implementation. So would the title would read, an act providing for the establishment of a statewide early childhood education plan and guidelines.
All right. Now, I planned on moving the bill, and so if there's any questions, we need to hear them now.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seed.
We didn't have any objections. The amendment was adopted. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Sorry. The amendment is adopted because there were no objections. Sorry about that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I think it was our last meeting or previously when this bill was heard. I can't remember if it was last time. We kind of discussed this, and I think there was generally a broad agreement, so perhaps we're ready to move the bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seed.
Could we get the Department of Education up just to, for one comment on the new CS here and see if we're at the point where we were trying to go?
Through the Chair, Representative Seed, this substitute is exactly where we were going to go. And we have submitted a revised fiscal note, which is a zero fiscal note for the development of the plan to be presented to the legislature next year.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I have one question for Eddie.
Eddie, Representative Roses.
Thank you. Eddie, on line page 3, line 17, where we have the words including Head Start, I know there was some concern before that was raised, and we had a little bit of a discussion on the fact that there's very little oversight by the department in terms of the Head Start programs. Is the department still comfortable with this language?
Through the Chair, Representative Roses, I'm still comfortable with this language. We want to involve the Head Start people in developing the plan, so I think it's absolutely appropriate.
Thank you.
Okay, and I'd like to have a brief of these. And we went off just to give the members a chance to, they kind of talked, discussed this last time, and we kind of gutted the bill, but we left one part in, and that was just to give the members a chance to make sure that it says what they had intended. So, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue actually is why we were, I don't want to speak for Representative Keller, but for me, was I received calls after, after the hearing of people in opposition to the bill moving forward, and I'll make the assumption because that's where I'm at, the people who called haven't had a chance to review what's here, so they're speaking, they can't speak to what was here to say if that actually meets what their concerns were. And one of the concerns expressed on the phone to the sponsor was that there had been a lot of work done, and Mr. Jeans and I actually talked about that offsite. In the it was some people that served on and helped me with the
Best
committee.
Beginnings.
No, not the HESS committee.
Best Beginnings.
Best Beginnings. Thank you very much. my ears are going to, on the best beginnings, and they wanted to make sure that those standards and the things, that conversation was discussed and brought forward. So I think that they've been incorporated and will have that ability to do that. And Mr. Jeans and I had, had talked about having the department actually take a long, hard look at the cost, and that is incorporated. So for the record, a component of the working draft of the CS that's before us includes incorporating the early learning guidelines adopted by the board under 1407-165-6 and provide for the most effective and efficient coordination with or expansion of pre-elementary programs operating in the state, including Head Start, to be to the extent permitted by law. So I think that there's enough walls on the issue that we can go through and look to see if there's something that we can do in a pilot type situation or a planning situation to go forward. So with that, I won't try to hold the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Do I hear a motion?
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 306, or committee substitute for House Bill 306 as amended from committee with individual recommendations and pending zero fiscal note.
Revised fiscal note, yeah. Hearing no objections, so moved. All right. And now what I'd like to do is just introduce House Bill 358, Needy Children, and just to get it introduced so that, just so that we can bring it up under bills previously heard, you know, so that it's just before us. And that's basically what I want to do. We've got 5 minutes left, so if you would like to just kind of give us just a short overview so that we have an idea of what's happening here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for the work on the last bill and the constructive suggestion on how to rewrite it. The House Bill, what's the number of the one we're up to now?
358.
House Bill 358 tries to address some of the major problems we have within our foster care system, the ones that we can get our arms around, I believe. And for the information of the committee, you probably know this already, roughly 2,000 children in the state of Alaska are in foster care. Roughly half of those are in foster care with extended family members, and the other half are in foster care that's not with family members. And we've had a number of problems in trying to improve the system. I believe, and you have folks on the phone that I would guess probably will not have a chance to testify, but I believe, and I would encourage you to speak to folks who are experts in this area, the Casey Foundation, the Casey Family Foundation, which I didn't know a lot about until this year, but now I know a lot more about, has been working on foster care reform across the country. And they can talk to you about some of the solvable problems in the foster care system, and those are addressed in this bill. The first one is that we have a shortage of social workers. Alaska is not unique this way. In many foster care systems across the country, there aren't enough social workers. That sounds like a dry subject, but this is what happens. We also have a shortage of foster families. What happens when you have a shortage of social workers are a few things. First, you have a hard time investigating abuse cases, and that's obvious, and that's a problem. But another thing you have is that when foster parents need the help they need, or they need social worker approval for something they want to do with the foster child, they don't get timely calls back often. And then they become frustrated. And then they don't want to become foster parents anymore. And so I heard an alarming comment from one of the social workers at OCS, which is, we have a shortage of foster parents, but we can't add any more foster parents and adequately serve them until we get more social workers. And so you've got this dual problem, which feeds on the other aspect repeatedly. So until you have enough social workers, you won't be able to solve the foster parent shortage. And you can talk to the experts more about the importance of social workers. So, and the social worker shortage is in two components. One is we have 20 open positions that are funded. And one is that an internal study done by OCS says, in addition, we're probably about 10 social workers and support staff short above the 20 and those haven't been funded yet. So we're working with the governor's office to try and fill the 20 positions that are open, and hopefully we'll get to the point that we've also added the funding for the additional ones. But until we get there, the rest of the reforms are going to be almost impossible to make great headway on. Another is the foster parent family reimbursement rate. That's only been updated once since 1992. The governor has proposed, and it's in the budget now, to increase that rate, which is good. But the problem is, if you do it every 10, 15 years, in the intervening 15 years, you keep falling behind. And so we have a provision in here that it should be updated every year. And just like nursing home reimbursement is, and some of the other aspects are. Two other problems. One is foster kids who move between schools do much worse than kids who stay in the same school. And so what happens is a foster kid will go between 5, 6, 7, 10 placements and 5, 6, 7, 10 schools and never complete the coursework they started in the beginning of the school year. So there's a federal law that helps keep kids in the same school by transportation funding. The federal law provides some transportation funding. School districts make up the rest. It's called the McKinney-Vento Act, but that only helps keep kids who are in waiting placement or in temporary foster care in the same school. It doesn't address kids in permanent foster care, and so as those kids move between homes, they're not protected. And so this redefines that law so that those kids will be protected too. And then there's another small aspect which can be a big problem, and the Casey Foundation could answer questions on this, which is often kids who move between schools, their transcripts don't follow them. Inside a school district, it tends to be okay. Between school districts, it tends not to be okay. And so you can't come up with an education plan for a kid if the records aren't following. And so these are all discrete problems that can all be solved, and we try to do it with this bill. We tried not to grab things that we couldn't get our arms around, but these four we could get our arms around. That's the summary.
Okay, thank you very much. And we're out of time, and there's members that cannot stay, so I apologize for those that have waited and didn't get to testify, and for the ones that are online. I really appreciate that you're there, and I am so sorry that we didn't get it. There's five people that are online that would have testified, and so I'm so sorry about that. But we will be unable to continue our meeting, and it is 5 o'clock, and we will gavel up.